This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Survivor 48 is here, and alongside it, we're bringing you a brand new season of On Fire, the only official Survivor podcast. If you're a Survivor superfan, you won't want to miss this deep dive into every episode where we break down how we designed the game, the biggest moves, your burning questions. It's the only podcast that gives you inside access to Survivor that nobody else can. Listen to On Fire, the official Survivor podcast with me, Jeff Probst, every Wednesday after the show, wherever you get your podcasts.
9:10 on this St. Joseph's Day. Joe Cardosi, I guess I should tell you, happy St. Joseph's Day. Cardosi is an Italian name. And will you be celebrating, going to any St. Joseph's altars or anything like that? All right. Give me a lucky bean if you do go anywhere, please. All right, do that. We're going to talk about the history of Italy today, as we did on Monday, the history of Ireland and the history of the Italians in America, and what led them to come here, and what happened after they did get here. I've had the privilege of going to both countries, and completely different. Ireland seems pretty much, well, for the most part, one culture other than the Irish Protestant thing. Italy seems like a bunch of different cultures to me, depending on what area you go to. With that, we welcome in our guest, Fred, forgive me, sir, Gardafi, how you say it? Professor, you there? Fred, you got me on mute?
No, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, hello? Sir, we can hear you fine. How do you pronounce your last name, sir?
Okay. It's Gardafi. It's actually part, it's Basque, French Basque, Gardafi.
Fred Gardafi, okay.
Right, but I'm 3/4 Italian, 1/4 French Basque.
We all want to be Italian on St. Joseph's Day. We all want to be Irish on St. Patrick's Day. Tell me about the country of Italy and a little bit of the history, and then we'll talk about the Italians in America. Because, again, I've been to both countries, and you heard me say, Ireland seems like a limited cultural difference, but Italy seems like a couple of different countries all in one.
Right. Italy is if you look at it, it's got a very strategic location between the east and the west. And so it's always been a land that has been occupied by many, many other groups coming through. The Arabs, the Normans came in from the north, the Africans from the south, and it's been a, you know, it's really one of those true multicultural countries back in the time when people thought, well, we're all Italian, you know, and today I think it's really coming forth even more so to see all this diversity that's inside of Italy. But there was a time period in which Italy was all these little kingdoms, these little lands, and primarily those lands were given out by the Pope in return for protection and tribute, you know, to him. You had the French up north and the Normans, and you had the English coming in the south, and you had, you know, the Spanish coming down. And, you know, at one point, the Spanish ruled the Naples and the Sicily area, in a area they used to call the Kingdom of Two Sicilies. And so in the 1860s, Garibaldi was recruited to chase out all of the foreign powers, and he poised himself almost to throw out the Pope. They were going to get rid of the Pope, but then they, in a last-minute compromise, they suggested that if they would have thrown out the Pope, then they would have had to fight all the other nations, including Ireland and England, which were pretty Catholic at the time. And so they decided to give Rome its own, give the Vatican, Catholics, its, the Vatican as a as an independent nation. And so you still have that today. But Italy has always been this these independent kingdoms that have kind of come together. And then when it did come together in 1861, the people who lived in southern Italy weren't too happy with the results. And so it began the largest, one of the largest mass emigration experiences in Western civilization.
In the 1860s, and that was about the same time as the Irish, or not really?
Yeah, the Irish were a little bit before. Irish were a little bit before, because what happened in Ireland was the English forced Ireland to change their agricultural habits, and they forced them to plant potatoes. And anybody who lives in Idaho knows that you need dry weather to have potatoes. And so that that the Irish would have a potato famine at some point should have been as no surprise. But the Irish were very strong supporters of the Pope, and the Italians were very strong critics of the Pope. And so when they meet in the United States, you get this instant friction. First of all, because the Irish, because they were occupied by the English, learned English language, so they knew some English when they came to the United States, and they were more easily assimilated into the United States, whereas the Italians were much more of a slower assimilation in terms of language, in terms of trusting public institutions and so on, whereas the Irish, they were at the center of a lot of those institutions.
Professor, let me jump in for a second, take a step back. I didn't really introduce you. This is Fred Gardafay, Distinguished Professor of English and Italian-American Studies at Queens College. CUNY, and the John D. Calandre Italian-American Institute, also the author of several books. I like to get the audience involved, and again, I'm getting some text here. So when you said at 504-260-1870, I'll remind the audience, that's the Oakmanard Jeweler Talk and Text line. When you said the Irish liked the Pope and the Italians didn't, is that because part of Italy or Rome was carved out for Vatican City? Take me through that.
Right. Well, what it was the English and the Irish were very Catholic early on, and it wasn't until Henry VIII that they began to change it to the Protestants, the Church of England, and so on. So what you have happening is there's still this incredible support for Rome as the center of Catholicism by the Irish, whereas the Italians, who have been occupied by the Catholic Church for millennia, know that, of the corruption that's there, and they've learned not to trust it. And so there's this kind of anti-clerical movement in Italy and this pro-clerical movement in Ireland. And when the Irish come to the United States, they're looking for ways to assimilate, to come into power. And so they take jobs at all the institutions. They take jobs in the police. They take jobs in the education. And they're the founders of the Catholic Church in the United States. Remember, the United States is pretty much a Protestant country until the Irish begin to come. So, real quick,
somebody else texted this, and Jesus never went to Italy. Why is the Catholic Church based in Italy? I'll just throw that out there. You can answer them.
All right, I can answer that. It's because when Jesus was persecuted in the Middle East, his followers didn't think that was a great place to hang out. So they started heading out away, and they ended up coming to Rome, because Rome was this kind of free city, and it was a good place to run away and hide if you're a Jesus supporter. You don't want to get persecuted in Jerusalem and all that. And so they come there, and they're the minority, and they end up becoming the majority of the country. A lot of that has to do with the way that they were able to convert the people they call the pagans, but the word paganus in Latin means peasants. And so these were the peasants who lived outside the city, They were considered the pagans because they still worshiped the land and they still had rituals according to the land and so on. So what you have happening is that the Christians end up taking over religion in the Italian area, and up until the 1860s, they're pretty much in power.
But at some point, Italians become intensely Catholic, right?
Yeah, right. No, this was like right after after the persecution of the Christians, because what happened was a lot of major leaders began having these conversion experiences, Constantine and so on. So they gave a lot of credibility to the Catholic Church, and you have this incredible Catholic empire that grows. And as it grows, the Pope gets more powerful, and he starts giving land to the people who support him. And eventually, there's a rebellion against that, and that's how Italy became a geopolitical nation in the 1860s. And really, Italy did not become a republic until after World War II. It was a monarchy prior to that. From 1860s until 1940s, it was a monarchy.
So let's talk about the Italians. They come to America 1860s. Their primary competitor is the Irish, or how did the Italians find their way?
You have to understand why in the 1860s are the Italians recruited to come to the United States? Two things are happening. One is the emancipation of the slaves, and so somebody needs to take their places on the plantations, and the Italians are very rural people, so they're recruited to take over the jobs in the plantations. That's why you have so many Italians in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And also you have the industrialization that's going on, especially after the Civil War, up in the North, and factories need bodies, they need numbers, they don't need smart people, they just need people to be able to do the piecework that they do. And so what you have happening is this great need for unskilled labor, and the Italians are not doing very well in Italy. They're doing things like they're taxing donkeys, which is what poor people need, and they're not taxing the cows, which is what rich people have. So it's kind of this battle of the rich versus the poor in Italy, and the poor are leaving. I mean, in a lot of other countries, they had revolutions. In Italy, they didn't have a revolution. Their revolution was everybody left. And they went to South America. They went to Canada. They went to the United States. So they come, and yes, their main competition is the Irish in terms of city life. And especially in places like New Orleans, they become very friendly with blacks. A lot of the white power people didn't like that. And there's many, many accounts of black Italian friendships that ended up both blacks and Italians being persecuted. And 100 years ago, you had those famous lynchings in New Orleans, which didn't have anything. Well, we could say it had something to do with race, but a lot of it had to do with just the political situation that the Italians found themselves in terms of being businessmen, trying to make a living in a place where, at that time, the power people were not Italians. So.
Unfortunately, Italian Americans can be lumped together, and people can think of them negatively with all the mob movies, this, that, the other thing. Right. Italian Americans, statistically, no more prone to crime than any other immigrant, are they?
That's correct. That's absolutely correct. I think it's like 0.07% of Italian Americans have been somehow connected to organized crime. A lot of that has to do with the media and the way the media paid attention to Italians coming in. Italians for a while replaced blacks in terms of the white person's fear of cultural contamination. And I wrote an essay called "We Weren't Always White." Mm-hmm. The Italians were able to become white because they stopped speaking the language, and their skin wasn't as dark as Italian. Although on my grandfather's passport, It says not on his passport, on his entry into the United States, it marks him as dark complexion. Mm. That they took the time to make that distinction, I think, is very important in terms of the history of Italians and their relation to racial situations in the United States. Most recently, the Italian American One Voice anti-defamation group was protesting just a couple of weeks ago, protesting Saturday Night Live for mentioning the fact that, for saying Italians aren't white. Mm. So the Italians are caught in this in-between situation, and writers have talked about them as being in-between people. Mm. I talk of them as being chameleons. I can get along in a black community, but I could also get along in a white community, and I look more white when I'm around blacks, and I look more black when I'm around whites.
I never even thought of it in a racial context before. I never had. Tell me what how the Italians fared as opposed to the Irish and other immigrant people, people that immigrated to the United States, and how the Italians found their way to success in America.
All right. What happened was, a lot of this has to do with language. A lot of Italians immediately changed their name. If their name was Bianco, they changed it to White. But it didn't do too much to have an American or an Anglican name if you spoke with an Italian accent. So it took a while. So the first thing to go was the abandonment of the language. The Italians were very reluctant to go to school. Their way of going ahead in life was to work, to get jobs. Family members got other family members' jobs, go work for Uncle Joey's construction crew. Uncle Joey eventually takes over the construction company, and it goes on and on. So the Italians, they made their power and their way into, being assimilated Americans through labor, through hard work, not through education. It wasn't until the 1960s that Italians became average in terms of education.
Wow!
But before the 60s, they were above average in terms of income. And so you have this, so they made it on the shoulders of money, not on the shoulders of education.
The money coming from skilled trades?
Not well. Some skilled trades, sure. There were a lot of seamstresses and a lot of tailors and a lot of
Rick Masons.
Mason. Yeah, but in terms of the ability to save money, to live on very little, to make the most out of little, to turn a bowl of pasta into something that could feed six people instead of one. My mother would always. On Fridays, if somebody came over to the house, she'd always throw another cup of water in the soup pot and say, "We got room for everybody. We could feed." So it actually cost nothing. When I remember, I used to take my grandmother hated restaurants. She hated restaurants because the food was no good, she said, and why should you pay for the things that you can make very cheaply? But she would freak out when she would see dandelion greens for $7 a plate, when we would pick the dandelion greens free in the forest preserves, and she'd cook them up and eat them. So by being very, very hard workers and being very frugal and really not joining in protests against discrimination of Italians and so on, I mean, those things didn't happen until Italians became middle class. And you can even see this reflected in TV shows like The Sopranos, where it's the middle class Italians who get upset about the way they are presented as gangsters. The working class Italian Americans don't get upset because they know that's not them.
Professor, before we let you go, if somebody wanted to celebrate St. Joseph's Day in a legitimate Italian style, an authentic Italian style, what would you suggest they do?
Well, first of all, there's no meats today. It's Lent, and so when they make their pasta, the Italians they call it St. Joseph's Day pasta. They make it with breadcrumbs and cheese and pasta. The Italians, you have to understand this. St. Joseph's Day in Italy is Father's Day, because St. Joseph was the father of Jesus. So it's really Father's Day in Italy. We have Father's Day in June here. And the Italians would set out tables of food for people who walked past their house. And that has morphed into, and there's this great tradition in New Orleans. You'll see them. Look for Google St. Joseph's Tables.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's particularly a Sicilian celebration where they cook food and they ask you for a donation. And these St. Joseph tables are out of this world. The food is fantastic.
A friend of mine, Teddy Tassan from St. Julian A. Martin, used to have one at the end of Lauderdale, my stream. We would enjoy it every year. Thank you, Professor. Very interesting.
Right.
Happy St. Joseph's Day to you.
This was great.
We'll talk to you again soon. Okay, you bet. Dr. Fred Gardafi, distinguished professor of English, Italian-American Studies at Queens College, John D. Colander, Italian-American Institute, also the author of several books. We'll take a break. We come back. We're going to talk about the New Orleans aspect of this and the Italians and the Sicilians and some of the celebrations planned with Peter Gilberti, president of the Italian-American St. Joseph Society. I love them both. St. Patrick's Day, St. Joseph's Day, a great two-day, a three-day.
Hey, I'm Andy. If you don't know me, it's probably because I'm not famous. But I did start a men's grooming company called Harry's. The idea for Harry's came out of a frustrating experience I had buying razor blades. Most brands were overpriced, overdesigned, and out of touch. At Harry's, our approach is simple. Here's our secret. We make sharp, durable blades and sell them at honest prices for as low as $2 each. We care about quality so much that we do some crazy things, like buy a world-class German blade factory. Obsessing over every detail means we're confident in offering a 100% quality guarantee. Millions of guys have already made the switch to Harry's, so thank you if you're one of them. And if you're not, we hope you give us a try with this special offer. Get a Harry starter set with a 5-blade razor, weighted handle, shave gel, and a travel cover. All for just $3 plus free shipping. Just go to harrys.com and enter code SHAVE at checkout. That's harrys.com, code SHAVE. Enjoy!
Man with a day of rest in between. Tommy Tucker back in a flash, WWL. Happy St. Joseph's Day 2025. Spending an hour talking about the Italian Americans as we did about the Irish Americans on St. Patrick's Day. Peter Gilberti joins us now, president of the Italian American St. Joseph Society. Happy St. Joseph's Day to you, sir.
Happy St. Joseph, Tommy. Viva San Giuseppe. Salute.
There you go. Tell me, Chindon is 100 years? What's the toast?
Shintani. You'll work on that, Tommy. You'll have it done by the end of our talk.
I hope so. Let's talk about your heritage. Have you traced it back?
I have. I am Italian on my father's side, reigning from Padua, which is in the Veneto area, and Liropoli, Convenza, which is in the Calabria region. And then you jump into the sea and swim over to Trapani, Erice, Sicily, on my mother's side. Mm-hmm. So I'm Italian on my father's side and Sicilian on my mother's side, which there is a difference. And everybody says, and I just went to Europe in the fall, and you know everybody's dubbed as being Italian, but if you talk to people, they'll say I'm Italian, and Sicilians will tell you I'm Sicilian.
Tell me what's the difference and why. Joseph?
I think it's just a regional thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just a regional thing.
Kind of like
you know,
East Bank, West Bank?
Yeah, East Bank, West Bank, or if you said, you know, you were an uptown person versus a Jefferson Parish suburbanite, you know, it's just a, I guess you would say, in the simplest term, it's a cliquish thing.
Mm-hmm. How many times have you been to Italy?
This is my first, unfortunately.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you enjoy it? I'm sure you did. That's a dumb question. What was your favorite part of it, or did you tour the entire country?
Actually, I started in Venice and spent a couple of days on the ground in Venice, and then I hopped on a cruise line, Oceania cruise line in in Slovenia and Trieste. And went down the Adriatic Sea. So I saw more than just Italy, you know, the Venice and then Croatia and Greece and Sicily and the island of Malta. And I ended up in Rome and spent some time in Rome. So I covered a lot of places in 2 weeks.
As did I when I went. It's hard to take it all in. I know they're not a big fan of the big cruise ships in St. Mark's Square at all. I don't know if they banned them or not, because they said the St. Mark's Square in Venice would just go dark when a big cruise ship passed, right?
Yeah, no, we had to water taxi. They won't let the cruise ships in. Yeah, we water taxied from our hotel there. But my wife and I both, we're ready when the time is right to get on the Big Bird and fly over and be on the ground in Italy, Sicily, and see as much as we can.
I know Newell Norman's a big fan of Italy as well. He loves going. Let's talk about the Italian American history in New Orleans and the important part that they played. If you would, Peter, please.
Well, the as history shows, Tommy, that in the 1800s, it was mostly, and we were talking about distinction, Sicilians came here from Sicily because they were, and if you're looking for distinctions, they were more apt to towards working in the farm industry, sugarcane and things such as that, which was indigenous to them. And the similarities that existed here. And I don't know exactly when, we'd have to do the research, mm-hmm. but see that it was, they were solicited from the United States for people to come here to take the place to work on the farms, in the sugarcane farms. And they came here. And of course, I don't know if they went through Ellis Island or came straight to New Orleans. My grandfather came straight to New Orleans from Sicily. He was a cobbler, but they came here and, they worked on the French Quarter. Standard Fruit Company mm-hmm. became heavily involved after years of the migration here, the French Market, basically, after a period of years, they started investing, not just working in the French Quarter and branching out to Plaquemines Parish, Independence, Louisiana, a meat in those areas, and working farms and with produce, sugarcane, et cetera. The ones that stayed here in the city, they ended up taking over the French Quarter, for lack of better terms, and they dubbed it Little Palermo in the 1800s because it was so heavily populated by Sicilian immigrants that came here.
Let me take a break. We're going to pick it up. We come back. We'll talk about some of the festivities going on as well. Peter Gilberti is our guest, president of the Italian-American St. Joseph Society, as Italian can get, both Italian and Sicilian. Would that be appropriate, Peter?
That would be appropriate. If my mother were with me, she would say that, make sure you say that you're Sicilian, son.
Do you guys have pasta with every meal? On holidays, et cetera?
I have this conversation all the time, Tommy, that we ate pasta on a Thursday night, but it was a lighter meal. It wasn't many courses, right? And uh-huh. it was pasta with the red sugo sauce or mm-hmm. gravy, whatever you want to term it. That there's a lot of debate about that, of what we call it here, but and some protein. But then on Sunday, that was first course. And then you had various other proteins that follow, whether it was roast or steak. And you had stuffed artichokes when they were in season, and multiple fresh vegetables, always fresh. We never ate things out of the freezer section or of a tin can. The Mediterranean diet, which is what they say is the healthiest.
Yeah, all right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back, 9:42, 18 till 10, traffic now, WWL. 9:49, 11 till 10. Happy St. Joseph's Day. Peter Gilberti, our guest, president of the Italian-American St. Joseph Society. Peter, tell me about some of the activities going on around the city today to celebrate. Tell me how you said it, St. Joseph's Day.
Viva San Giuseppe.
Viva San Giuseppe. There you go. What are some of the stuff, some of the things going on?
Well, as far as my awareness, Tommy, there's numerous St. Joseph altars. That stems back to the paying homage to Saint Joseph. Many, many years ago in Sicily, there was a famine due to a drought, and the Sicilians turned to their patron saint, Saint Joseph, the stepfather of Christ, right? And prayed to him for rain, and the rains came, and the crops grew, and the most prevalent crop was, that's why they call it a lucky bean here in America, was the fava bean. Mm-hmm. And favas actually are very good. If you've never eaten them, you know, you shuck them out of the shell, and then you saute them with a little olive oil, garlic, and onions, and it's delicious. But the part of the paying homage, part of the promise, that was that, you know, that they would have this bountiful feast in representation of, you know, if their prayers came true, and pay homage to St. Joseph each and every year. And that's where the altars began. And if you look at the food that's on the altars, you know, the artichokes and the fish, and they do the pasta melanesa, which, you know, the anchovies or the sardines that in there, you know, represent the salt. It represents the tears that Christ shed on the cross. The breadcrumb topping, they call, which I'm about to go pick up about 50 pounds of that from somebody who makes it for us for our big deal tomorrow. The mudika is fried breadcrumbs with sugar and olive oil, and that's thrown over the top, as opposed where you would put, you know, cheese, pecorino romano, whatever you want on top of, and they use that. Those, that represents the sawdust of St. Joseph the carpenter. So the various other dishes that are on the St. Joseph altar, all of that is to pay homage. And that is happening. It used to, you know, I'm 63 years old, and when I was a child, that happened more so in homes. Mm-hmm. And then as years progressed and things changed, and then schools started doing it, and they do it in their churches, you know, Catholic schools, and they do it in their gymnasiums. You know, there may be public ones. Dornack's grocery store has one on display. Rouse's grocery store, they have Italian lineage in both of those stores, and they put a St. Joseph altar. That's happening all around today.
I think Carmel used to do one. My kid went to Mount Carmel.
Mount Carmel Academy does one. If you went on the internet, and you'd find the whole list. We have one on our website of all the area schools, churches, et cetera, that have one. Mount Carmel Academy, Holy Rosary does one. Chappelle High School does one. I believe Jesuit does one. De La Salle. They all today pay homage to St. Joseph in that way with the altar. That's what's happening today. It's a viewing yesterday, a viewing today, and then depending upon their schedules at certain times, you have St. Joseph over in Gretna, which is a huge one. Mm. That goes back many generations. And after the viewing, they will feed the masses, as I say, feed the people. You come in, you make a donation, and whatever they have that's typical of a St. Joseph altar, you can sit down and have a lunch, or tonight, you know, evening, a meal. And that's what's going on around the city today.
What's the website, Peter?
Our website is ItalianAmericanSt.JosephSociety.org.
All right, people can go there and find out. Real quick, what's your favorite thing on the St. Joseph altar?
I know my wife may be listening. She's at work. I'm off today, fortunately. I would go for the pasta melanese, the artichokes, and for a sweet tooth, the cucciadotti. The cucciadotti is the fig cookie.
Yeah.
The cookie stuff with the figs, and it's, as the little kids would say, it's got sprinkles on the top, right?
They're
donuts.
I presume you've had cassata cake?
Yes, I've had cassata.
Oh,
I'm not a big cake person, and also the sesame seed cookies, too.
Okay, I think that cassata cake.
You go to Bricata's. Yeah. I keep plugging people. You go to Bricata's, and you'll find everything that under the sun that you would want that's a Sicilian confectionery right there.
That cassata cake reminded me of wedding cake and cheesecake all together. Happy St. Joseph's Day, Peter. Thank you so much for taking the time.
You.
Hope you have a fantastic day. And tell me again how to say 100 years.
Shintani. And tomorrow is our 500 pounds pasta con lasardi at the Hilton Riverside Hotel, high noon, open to the public. And then Saturday will be our parade at 6 p.m. Convention Center and Porter Street, and we'll make our way over into the French Quarter, as I said earlier, Little Palermo, and then back to the Hilton for a gala beginning at 9 p.m., a ticketed event, and we will dance, sing, and party into the wee hours of the night.
Shintani.
Shintani, Tommy. Thank you very much.
You bet. We'll
appreciate
take a break.
The support.
Thank you, sir. Happy St. Joseph's Day. We'll talk to Newell when we come back. WWL. Nine ten on this St. Joseph's Day. Joe Cardosi, I guess I should tell you happy St. Joseph's Day. Cardosi is an Italian name. And will you be celebrating, going to any St. Joseph's altars or anything like that? All right. Well, give me a lucky bean if you do go anywhere, please. All right, do that. We're going to talk about the history of Italy today, as we did on Monday, the history of Ireland and the history of the Italians in America, and what led them to come here, and what happened after they did get here. I've had the privilege of going to both countries, and completely different. Ireland seems pretty much, well, for the most part, one culture other than the Irish Protestant thing. Italy seems like a bunch of different cultures to me, depending on what area you go to. With that, we welcome in our guest, Fred. Forgive me, sir. Gardafi? How you say it? Professor, you there? Fred, you got me on mute?
No, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes,
hello?
Sir. We can hear you fine. How do you pronounce your last name, sir?
Okay. It's Gardafi.
Gardafi.
It's actually part, it's Basque, French Basque, Gardafi.
Fred Gardafi. Okay.
Right, but I'm three quarters Italian, one quarter French Basque.
We all want to be Italian on St. Joseph's Day. We all want to be Irish on St. Patrick's Day. Tell me about the country of Italy and a little bit of the history, and then we'll talk about the Italians in America. Because, again, I've been to both countries, and you heard me say Ireland seems like a limited cultural difference, but Italy seems like a couple of different countries all in one.
Right. Italy is if you look at it, it's got a very strategic location between the east and the west. And so it's always been a land that has been occupied by many, many other groups coming through. The Arabs, the Normans came in from the north, the Africans from the south, and it's been a, you know, it's really one of those true multicultural countries. Back in the time when people thought, well, we're all Italian, you know, and today I think it's really coming forth even more so to see all this diversity that's inside of Italy. But there was a time period in which Italy was all these little kingdoms, these little lands, and primarily those lands were given out by the Pope in return for protection and tribute, you know, to him. You had the French up north and the Normans, and you had the English coming in the south, and you had, you know, the Spanish coming down, and you know, at one point, the Spanish ruled the Naples and the Sicily area, in a area they used to call the Kingdom of Two Sicilies. And so in the 1860s, Garibaldi was recruited to chase out all of the foreign powers, and he poised himself almost to throw out the Pope. They were going to get rid of the Pope. But then they, in a last-minute compromise, they suggested that if they would have thrown out the Pope, then they would have had to fight all the other nations, including Ireland and England, which were pretty Catholic at the time. And so they decided to give Rome its own, give the Vatican, Catholics, it's the Vatican as an independent nation. And so you still have that today. But Italy has always been these independent kingdoms that have kind of come together. And then when it did come together in 1861, the people who lived in southern Italy weren't too happy with the results. And so it began one of the largest mass emigration experiences in Western civilization.
In the 1860s, and that was about the same time as the Irish, or not really?
The Irish were a little bit before.
Mm-hmm.
Irish were a little bit before because
what happened in Ireland was the English forced Ireland to change their agricultural habits, and they forced them to plant potatoes. And anybody who lives in Idaho knows that you need dry weather to have potatoes. And so that the Irish would have a potato famine at some point should have been as no surprise. But the Irish were very strong supporters of the Pope, and the Italians were very strong critics of the Pope. And so when they meet in the United States, you get this instant friction. First of all, because the Irish, because they were occupied by the English, learned English language, so they knew some English when they came to the United States, and they were more easily assimilated into the United States, whereas the Italians were much more of a slower assimilation in terms of language, in terms of trusting public institutions and so on, whereas the Irish, they were at the center of a lot of those institutions.
Professor, let me jump in for a second, take a step back. I didn't really introduce you. This is Fred Gardafay, Distinguished Professor of English and Italian-American Studies at Queens College. CUNY, and the John D. Calandre Italian-American Institute, also the author of several books. I like to get the audience involved, and again, I'm getting some text here. So when you said at 504-260-1870, I'll remind the audience, that's the Oakmanar Jeweler Talk and text line. When you said the Irish liked the Pope and the Italians didn't, is that because part of Italy or Rome was carved out for Vatican City? Take me through that.
Right. Well, what it was, you know, the English and the Irish were very Catholic early on, and it wasn't until Henry VIII that they began to change it to the Protestants, the Church of England, and so on. So what you have happening is there's still this incredible support for Rome as the center of Catholicism by the Irish, whereas the Italians, who have been occupied by the Catholic Church for millennia, know that, you know, of the corruption that's there, and they've learned not to trust it. And so there's this kind of anti-clerical movement in Italy and this pro-clerical movement in Ireland. And when the Irish come to the United States, they're looking for ways to assimilate, to come into power. And so they take jobs in all the institutions. They take jobs in the police. They take jobs in the education. And they're the founders of the Catholic Church in the United States. You know, remember, the United States is pretty much a Protestant country until the Irish begin to come. So, real quick,
and somebody else texted this in, Jesus never went to Italy. Why is the Catholic Church based in Italy? I'll just throw that out there. You can answer them.
All right, I can answer that. It's because when Jesus was persecuted in the Middle East, his followers didn't think that was a great place to hang out. So they started heading out away, and they ended up coming to Rome because Rome was this kind of free city, and it was a good place to run away and hide if you're a Jesus supporter. You don't want to get persecuted in Jerusalem and all that. And so they come there, and they're the minority, and they end up becoming the majority of the country. A lot of that has to do with the way that they were able to convert the people they call the pagans, but the word paganus in Latin means peasants. And so these were the peasants who lived outside the city. They were considered the pagans because they still worshiped the land and they still had rituals according to the land and so on. So what you have happening is that the Christians end up taking over religion in the Italian area, and up until the 1860s, they're pretty much in power.
But at some point, Italians become intensely Catholic, right?
Yeah, right. No, this was like right after after the persecution of the Christians, because what happened was a lot of major leaders began having these conversion experiences, Constantine and so on. So they gave a lot of credibility to the Catholic Church, and you have this incredible Catholic empire that grows. And as it grows, the Pope gets more powerful, and he starts giving land to the people who support him. And eventually there's a rebellion against that. And that's how Italy became a geopolitical nation in the 1860s. And really, Italy did not become a republic until after World War II. It was a monarchy prior to that. From 1860s until 1940s, it was a monarchy.
So let's talk about the Italians. They come to America 1860s. Their primary competitor is the Irish, or how did the Italians find their way?
You have to understand why in the 1860s are the Italians recruited to come to the United States? Two things are happening. One is the emancipation of the slaves, and so somebody needs to take their places on the plantations, and the Italians are very rural people, so you know they're recruited to take over the jobs in the plantations. That's why you have so many Italians in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And also you have the industrialization that's going on, especially after the Civil War, up in the North. And you know, factories need bodies. They need numbers. They don't need smart people. They just need people to be able to do, you know, the piecework that they do. And so what you have happening is this great need for unskilled labor, and the Italians are you know, they're not doing very well in Italy. They're doing things like they're taxing donkeys, which is what poor people need, and they're not taxing the cows, which is what rich people have. So it's kind of this battle of the rich versus the poor in Italy, and the poor are leaving. I mean, they're, you know, in a lot of other countries they had revolutions. In Italy, they didn't have a revolution. Their revolution was everybody left. And they went to South America, they went to Canada, they went to in the United States. So they come, and yes, their main competition is the Irish in terms of city life. And especially in places like New Orleans, they become very friendly with blacks. And, you know, a lot of the white power people didn't like that. And there's many, many accounts of black Italian friendships that you know, ended up both blacks and Italians being persecuted. And you know, 100 years ago, you had or more, you had those famous lynchings in New Orleans, which didn't have anything. Well, we could say it had something to do with race, but a lot of it had to do with you know, just the political situation that the Italians found themselves in terms of being businessmen, trying to make a living in a place where, you know, at that time, the power people were not Italians. So.
Unfortunately, Italian Americans can be lumped together, and people can think of them negatively with all the mob movies, this, that, the other thing. Right. Italian Americans, statistically, no more prone to crime than any other immigrant, are they?
That's correct. That's absolutely correct. I think it's like 0.07% of Italian Americans have been somehow connected to organized crime. You know, a lot of that has to do with the media and the way the media paid attention to Italians coming in. You know, Italians for a while replaced blacks in terms of the white person's fear of cultural contamination. And, you know, I mean, I wrote an essay called "We Weren't Always White." Mm-hmm. You know, the Italians were able to become white because they stopped speaking the language, and you know, their skin wasn't as dark as Italian. Although on my grandfather's passport, it says not on his passport, on his entry into the United States, it marks him as dark complexion. Mm. That they took the time to make that distinction, I think, is very important in terms of the history of Italians and their relation to racial situations in the United States. Most recently, the Italian American One Voice anti-defamation group was protesting just a couple of weeks ago, protesting Saturday Night Live for mentioning the fact that, you know, for saying Italians aren't white. Mm. So the Italians are caught in this in-between situation, and you know, writers have talked about them as being in-between people. Mm. You know, I talk of them as being chameleons. I can get along in a black community, but I could also get along in a white community, and I look more white when I'm around blacks, and I look more black when I'm around whites.
Hmm. I never even thought of it in a racial context before. I never had. Tell me what how the Italians fared as opposed to the Irish and other immigrant people, people that immigrated to the United States, and how the Italians found their way to success in America.
All right. What happened was, a lot of this has to do with language. A lot of Italians immediately changed their name. If their name was Bianco, they changed it to White. But it didn't do too much to have an American or an Anglican name if you spoke with an Italian accent. So it took a while. So the first thing to go was the abandonment of the language. The Italians were very reluctant to go to school. Their way of going ahead in life was to work, to get jobs. Family members got other family members' jobs, go work for Uncle Joey's construction crew. Uncle Joey eventually takes over the construction company, and it goes on and on. So the Italians, they made their power and their way into, being assimilated Americans through labor, through hard work, not through education. It wasn't until the 1960s that Italians became average in terms of education.
Wow!
But before the 60s, they were above average in terms of income. And so you have this, so they made it on the shoulders of money, not on the shoulders of education.
The money coming from skilled trades?
Not well. Some skilled trades, sure. There were a lot of seamstresses and a lot of tailors and a lot of
Rick Masons.
Mason. Yeah, but in terms of the ability to save money, to live on very little, to make the most out of little, to turn a bowl of pasta into something that could feed six people instead of one. My mother would always. On Fridays, if somebody came over to the house, she'd always throw another cup of water in the soup pot and say, "We got room for everybody. We could feed." So it actually cost nothing. When I remember, I used to take my grandmother hated restaurants. She hated restaurants because the food was no good, she said, and why should you pay for the things that you can make very cheaply? But she would freak out when she would see dandelion greens for $7 a plate. When we would pick the dandelion greens free in the forest preserves, and she'd cook them up and eat them. So by being very, very hard workers and being very frugal, and really not joining in protests against discrimination of Italians and so on. I mean, those things didn't happen until Italians became middle class, and you can even see this. It's reflected in TV shows like The Sopranos, where it's the middle-class Italians who get upset about the way they are presented as gangsters. The working-class Italian-Americans don't get upset because they know that's not them.
Professor, before we let you go, if somebody wanted to celebrate St. Joseph's Day in a legitimate Italian style, an authentic Italian style, what would you suggest they do?
Well, first of all, there's no meats today. It's Lent, and so when they make their pasta, the Italians they call it St. Joseph's Day pasta. They make it with breadcrumbs and cheese and pasta. The Italians, you have to understand this: St. Joseph's Day in Italy is Father's Day, because St. Joseph was the father of Jesus. So it's really Father's Day in Italy. We have Father's Day in June here. And the Italians would set out tables of food for people who walked past their house, and that has morphed into. And there's this great tradition in New Orleans. You'll see them. Look for Google St. Joseph's tables.
Oh yeah,
because it's particularly a Sicilian celebration where they cook food and they ask you for a donation. And these St. Joseph tables are out of this world. The food is fantastic.
A friend of mine, Teddy Tassan from St. Julian A. Martin, used to have one at the end of Lauderdale, my stream. We would enjoy it every year. Thank you, Professor. Very interesting.
Right.
Happy St. Joseph's Day to you.
This was great.
We'll talk to you again soon. Okay, you bet. Dr. Fred Gardafi. Distinguished Professor of English, Italian-American Studies at Queens College, John D. Calandra, Italian-American Institute, also the author of several books. We'll take a break. We come back. We're going to talk about the New Orleans aspect of this and the Italians and the Sicilians and some of the celebrations planned with Peter Gilberti, president of the Italian-American St. Joseph Society. I love them both. St. Patrick's Day, St. Joseph's Day, a great two-day, a three-day span with a day of rest in between. Tommy Tucker back in a flash, WWL. Happy St. Joseph's Day 2025. Spending an hour talking about the Italian Americans as we did about the Irish Americans on St. Patrick's Day. Peter Gilberti joins us now, president of the Italian American St. Joseph Society. Happy St. Joseph's Day to you, sir.
Happy St. Joseph, Tommy. Viva San Giuseppe. Salute.
There you go. Tell me, Chindon is 100 years? What's the toast?
Shintani. You know, work on that, Tommy. You'll have it done by the end of our talk.
I hope so. Let's talk about your heritage. Have you traced it back?
I have. I am Italian on my father's side, reigning from Padua, which is in the Veneto area, and Liropoli, Convenza, which is in the Calabria region. And then you jump into the sea and swim over to Trapani, Erice, Sicily, on my mother's side. Mm-hmm. So I'm Italian on my father's side and Sicilian on my mother's side, which there is a difference. And everybody says, and I just went to Europe in the fall, and you know everybody's dubbed as being Italian. But if you talk to people, they'll say I'm Italian, and Sicilians will tell you I'm Sicilian.
Tell me what's the difference and why. Joseph?
I think it's just a regional thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just a regional thing.
And like
you know,
East Bank, West Bank?
Yeah, East Bank, West Bank, or if you said, you know, you were an uptown person versus a Jefferson Parish suburbanite, you know, it's just a, I guess you would say, in the simplest term, it's a cliquish thing.
Mm-hmm. How many times have you been to Italy?
This is my first, unfortunately.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you enjoy it? I'm sure you did. That's a dumb question. What was your favorite part of it, or did you tour the entire country?
Actually, I started in Venice and spent a couple of days on the ground in Venice, and then I hopped on a cruise line, Oceania cruise line in in Slovenia and Trieste. And went down the Adriatic Sea. So I saw more than just Italy, you know, the Venice and then Croatia and Greece and Sicily and the island of Malta. And I ended up in Rome and spent some time in Rome. So I covered a lot of places in 2 weeks.
As did I when I went. It's hard to take it all in. I know they're not a big fan of the big cruise ships in St. Mark's Square at all. I don't know if they banned them or not because they said the St. Mark's Square in Venice would just go dark when a big cruise ship passed, right?
Yeah, no, we had to water taxi. They won't let the cruise ships in. Yeah, we water taxi from our hotel there. But my wife and I both, we're ready when the time is right to get on the big bird and fly over and be on the ground in Italy, Sicily, and you know, see as much as we can.
I know Newell Norman's a big fan of Italy as well. He loves going. Let's talk about the Italian American history in New Orleans and the important part that they played. If you would, Peter, please.
Well, as history shows, Tommy, that in the 1800s, it was mostly, and we were talking about distinction, Sicilians came here from Sicily because they were, and if you're looking for distinctions, they were more apt to towards working in the farm industry, sugarcane and things such as that, which you know was indigenous to them. And the similarities that existed here. And I mean, it was, I don't know exactly when, we'd have to do the research, mm-hmm. but see that it was, they were solicited from the United States for people to come here to take the place to work on the farms, you know, in the sugarcane farms. And they came here. And of course, you know, I don't know if they went through Ellis Island or came straight to New Orleans. My grandfather came straight to New Orleans from Sicily. He was a cobbler, but they came here and,
you know, they worked in the French Quarter. What was it? Standard Fruit Company became heavily involved after years of the migration here. The French Market, you know, basically after a period of years, you know, they started investing, not just working in the French Quarter and branching out to Plaquemines Parish, Independence, Louisiana, a meat in those areas, and working farms and with produce, sugarcane, et cetera. The ones that stayed here in the city, they ended up taking over the French Quarter, for lack of better terms, and they dubbed it Little Palermo in the 1800s because it was so heavily populated by Sicilian immigrants that came here.
Let me take a break. We're going to pick it up. We come back. We'll talk about some of the festivities going on as well. Peter Gilberti is our guest, president of the Italian-American St. Joseph Society, as Italian can get, both Italian and Sicilian. Would that be appropriate, Peter?
That would be appropriate. If my mother were with me, she would say that, you know, make sure you say that you're Sicilian, son.
Do you guys have pasta with every meal on holidays, et cetera?
I have this conversation all the time, Tommy, that we ate pasta on a Thursday night, but it was a lighter meal. It wasn't many courses, right? And it was pasta with the red sugo sauce or gravy, whatever you want to term it. You know, that there's a lot of debate about that, of what we call it here, but and some protein. But then on Sunday, that was first course. And then you had various other proteins that follow, you know, whether it was roast or steak. And I mean, you know, you had stuffed artichokes when they were in season, and multiple fresh vegetables, always fresh. We never ate things out of the freezer section or of a tin can. The Mediterranean diet, which is what they say is the healthiest.
Yeah, all right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. 9:42, 18 till 10. Traffic now, WWL. 9:49, 11 till 10. Happy St. Joseph's Day. Peter Gilberti, our guest, president of the Italian-American St. Joseph Society. Peter, tell me about some of the activities going on around the city today to celebrate. Tell me how you said it, St. Joseph's Day.
Viva San Giuseppe.
Viva San Giuseppe. There you go. What are some of the stuff, some of the things going on?
Well, as far as my awareness, Tommy, I mean, that there's numerous St. Joseph altars. You know, that stems back to the paying homage to Saint Joseph. Again, you know, many years ago in Sicily, there was a famine due to a drought, and the Sicilians turned to their patron saint, Saint Joseph, the stepfather of Christ, right? And prayed to him for rain, and the rains came. And the crops grew, and the most prevalent crop was, that's why they call it a lucky bean here in America, was the fava bean. And favas actually are very good if you've never eaten them. You know, you shuck them out of the shell, and then you saute them with a little olive oil, garlic, and onions, and it's delicious. But the part of the paying homage, part of the promise, That was that, you know, that they would have this bountiful feast in representation of, you know, if their prayers came true, and pay homage to St. Joseph each and every year. And that's where the altars began. And if you look at the food that's on the altars, you know, the artichokes and the fish, and they do the pasta melanesa, which, you know, the anchovies or the sardines that in there, you know, represent the salt. It represents the tears that Christ shed on the cross. The breadcrumb topping, they call, which I'm about to go pick up about 50 pounds of that from somebody who makes it for us for our big deal tomorrow. The mudica is fried breadcrumbs with sugar and olive oil, and that's thrown over the top, as opposed where you would put, you know, cheese, pecorino romano, whatever you want on top of, and they use that. Those, that represents the sawdust of Saint Joseph the carpenter. So, and the various other dishes that are on the Saint Joseph altar. All of that is to pay homage. And that is happening. It used to, you know, I'm 63 years old. And when I was a child, that happened more so in homes. Mm-hmm. And then as years progressed and things changed, and then schools started doing it, and they do it in their churches, you know, Catholic schools, and they do it in their gymnasiums. You know, there may be public ones. Dornack's grocery store has one on display. Rouse's grocery store, they have Italian lineage in both of those stores, and they put a St. Joseph altar. That's happening all around today.
I think Carmel used to do one. My kid went to Mount Carmel.
Mount Carmel Academy does one. If you went on the internet and you'd find a whole list. We have one on our website of all the area schools, churches, etc. that have one. Mount Carmel Academy, Holy Rosary does one. Chappelle High School does one. I believe Jesuit does one. De La Salle. They all today pay homage to St. Joseph in that way with the altar. That's what's happening today. It's a viewing yesterday, a viewing today, and then depending upon their schedules at certain times, you have St. Joseph over in Gretna, which is a huge one. Mm. That goes back many generations. And after the viewing, they will feed the masses, as I say, feed the people. You come in, you make a donation, and whatever they have that's typical of a St. Joseph altar, you can sit down and have a lunch, or tonight, you know, evening, a meal. And that's what's going on around the city today.
What's the website, Peter?
Our website is ItalianAmericanSt.JosephSociety.org.
All right, people can go there and find out real quick. What's your favorite thing on the St. Joseph altar?
I know my wife may be listening. She's at work. I'm off today, fortunately. I would go for the pasta milanese, the artichokes, and for a sweet tooth, the cucciadotti. The cucciadotti is the fig cookie.
Yeah.
The cookie stuff with the figs, and it's, as the little kids would say, it's got sprinkles on the top, right?
Like
donuts.
I presume you've had cassata cake?
Yes, I've had cassata. I'm not a big cake person, and also the sesame seed cookies too.
Okay, I think that cassata cake.
You go to Bricata's. Yeah. I keep plugging people. You go to Bricata's and you'll find everything that under the sun that you would want. That's a Sicilian confectionery right there.
That cassata cake reminded me of wedding cake and cheesecake all together. Happy St. Joseph's Day, Peter. Thank you so much for taking the time.
You.
Hope you have a fantastic day. And tell me again how to say 100 years.
Shintani. And tomorrow is our 500-pound pasta con lasardi at the Hilton Riverside Hotel, high noon, open to the public. And then Saturday will be our parade at 6 p.m. Convention Center and Porger Street. And we'll make our way over into the French Quarter, as I said earlier, Little Palermo, and then back to the Hilton for a gala beginning at 9 p.m., a ticketed event, and we will dance, sing, and party into the wee hours of the night.
Shintani.
Shintani, Tommy. Thank you very much.
You bet. We'll
appreciate
take a break.
Support.
Thank you, sir. Happy St. Joseph's Day. We'll talk to Newell when we come back. WWL.